South Dakota, the Honorable Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. Thank you. Good morning. We are grateful to be able to be here at Northern State University to hear our cases for the March term of court. Most of our court sessions we hold in Pierre in the courtroom there, and twice a year we try to travel around the state and give opportunities for the public, high school students. I know we have a number of high school students here and others to participate and see what the court does and its work in deciding cases that come up on appeal. We're grateful for Northern State University's hospitality. President Schnorr and the staff here at Northern State have been very gracious, and we appreciate that they've allowed us to come and sit here for the next couple of days and hear cases. There are some high school, local high schools that are here today. Northwestern High School from Millett, Sunshine Bible Academy from Miller, Webster High School, and Aberdeen Central. So welcome to all of those students from those high schools. This morning we'll be hearing three cases. The first case that the court will hear is Todd Whelan versus Patrick Booman, arguing on behalf of the plaintiff appellant. Mr. Whelan is Michael Bornitz, and arguing on behalf of Mr. Booman is Melanie Carpenter. Each side will have 20 minutes for your initial arguments, and then Mr. Bornitz, you'll have a 10-minute rebuttal. With that, you can proceed, Mr. Bornitz.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, counsel. This is a case about a South Dakota highway patrolman who caused a crash when he performed a U-turn on a busy South Dakota highway in a no-passing zone when his view of oncoming traffic was obstructed. The parties have appealed quite a number of issues in this case, and I'm going to focus on just a few of them today in our limited time. I don't mean to waive submission to the court of the other issues. The first issue that I would like to address is contributory negligence. The trial court, in our view, erred in not granting our motion for summary judgment on the issue of contributory negligence. The defense alleged in this case that Dr. Whelan was contributorily negligent for going 3 to 4 miles per hour over the speed limit in the seconds before hitting the brakes in this crash. And the jury's verdict included a finding that Dr. Whelan was at fault. This court, on a number of occasions, has reversed contributory negligence verdicts based on a lack of causation. And we would respectfully submit that that's what should happen here. And by causation, what I mean is that causation can be shown in one of a couple of different ways. First, as an example, that the speed contributed to cause the crash. Or second, that the speed contributed to cause the injuries or to increase the injuries or make them worse. And here, there was no expert testimony that going 3 to 4 miles per hour over the speed limit before Dr. Whelan hit the brakes contributed as a legal cause to this crash. The defendant's engineering expert was precluded from offering opinions on contributory negligence based on our motions in limine.
Counsel?
Yes.
Does the governing law require there to be expert testimony in these circumstances?
In a situation like this, it does. This court has said that issues like this cannot be based on mere speculation. And what we're talking about here is whether applied from an accident reconstructionist standpoint or an engineering standpoint, would going 3 to 4 seconds 3 to 4 miles per hour over the speed limit contribute as a legal cause to this crash. And the defense submitted to this court that the jury could use some calculations that their engineering expert talked about in respect to another issue at trial. And I think we're all reasonably intelligent people. I've helped my kids with their math and with their science, but to expect that the jury is going to take some esoteric formula and then apply it to this case is a fallible suggestion.
So which formula are you referring to? You're referring to the distance over time that's covered?
Yes.
Is that even in the record?
I don't know that it's in the record. If I'm assuming that it was, Justice Salter, I don't specifically know that it was. There was a lot of testimony by Jerry Ogden. But again, that's not, he was not permitted and did not testify that driving 3 to 4 miles per hour over the speed limit contributed as a legal cause to this crash.
And so could the jury say, so leaving that formula off to the side, but Dr. Ogden did talk about the rate of downward acceleration, provided expert opinions about what that was generally and how it manifests itself specifically in this case. In fact, even in that last second, he said, you know, you got to account for this last second. And then he sort of tied that together, it seemed like anyway, with the width of the impact on Mr. Whelan's car, that 15 inches right over there. Did the jury figure something out on their own, or does it have to have an expert to draw all of that together in terms of causation?
No, for something like that, that requires the application of speed and time and distance, it invariably requires expert testimony. Sort of like the second way you can prove causation is by showing that but for going 3 to 4 miles per hour over the speed limit, the injuries would have been worse. That requires a doctor's testimony.
I don't know if the briefs mentioned it, and if they did, maybe I'm forgetting it, but when I read the record trial, I noticed that Dr. Weiland said that he, as the patrol car is coming from left to right across that lane of travel that he's in, he said he went to the right over onto the shoulder. Could the jury, and I don't know if that was really even argued, but you know, the jury made a general finding of contributory negligence. Could the jury perhaps find something from the fact that he drifted to the right, maybe instinctively, and maybe you don't think that's evidence of contributory fault, but what about that testimony?
I don't think that that goes to the issue of causation, Justice Salter. I think that the jury could find him negligent for going 3 to 4 miles per hour over the speed limit in the seconds before the crash. But if you look closely at the briefs, the same event data recorder showed that he was actually going 65 miles per hour 1 second before the crash. So, you know, and obviously at the time of the crash, he was going slower.
But 47 miles an hour.
It requires expert testimony. There's just no doubt about that. And with regard to the second way, that going 3 to 4 miles per hour had some effect on the injuries, Dr. Carlson, who was the defense's medical doctor in this case, never offered any opinion in that regard. Their sole argument for contributory negligence was Dr. Whelan was speeding, and that's not enough.
And if you're right that issue shouldn't have gone to the jury, your theory of prejudice is that the jury was instructed. We don't know how much they reduced damages, if any, but the jury was instructed they must reduce damages if the plaintiff was found contributorily negligent.
That's correct, Chief Justice Jensen. The jury instructions say that they must. Now, we don't know how much, but we have to presume that they followed the jury instructions. That's our presumption that this court says.
Counsel, will you address 10-2060, the insurance instruction?
Yes.
I'm sure that may be on your list.
It is. It's on my short list. So this issue of insurance, as it sometimes does, came up during jury selection in this case. Jurors are curious, and they asked about it. And on the third day of trial, one of the jurors writes a question and gives it to the bailiff, and they wanted to know who pays for the verdict. Now, just for a little bit of context, the South Dakota Highway Patrol was dismissed from this case based on sovereign immunity. So who do we have sitting here? We have Patrick Booman. And during the trial, the jury wanted to know where the money to pay the verdict was going to come from. They specifically asked, does he have to pay for it? And the trial court refused our request to give the pattern jury instruction on insurance. And the jury subsequently returned a verdict of $18,000 approximately. And that verdict was like about one-third or a little less than one-third of Dr. Whelan's total medical bills in this case. So on the one hand, we have a young law enforcement officer, and on the other hand, we have an experienced chiropractor working at the Ortman Clinic. And the prejudice in not getting that instruction is that there's no other instruction that the jury was given that this court could say, well, you know, this other instruction covers this subject. And so it is, and the requested pattern instruction is undisputedly a correct statement of the law. And failure to give an instruction under those circumstances, this court has found to be reversible error.
So we would review that under an abuse of discretion standard?
Yes.
Very deferential. It's not so much whether in the moment or even with the benefit of hindsight any one of the judges here would make the same call or not, but really whether that call that the trial court judge made in the moment was within a range of permissible choices. In other words, the standard contemplates there is no one right answer. There could be more than one. How is this an abuse of discretion in that, viewed with that sort of deferential standard?
Well, and it goes to that question. The jury asked the question, where does the money come from? Does he have to pay for it? And that's why we requested the pattern jury instruction, so we can talk to the jury about this issue of who pays. That is not a permissible subject matter for the jury to deliberate about and to discuss. Whether it comes from Dr. Whelan's health insurance for some of the medical bills is not a permissible subject for the jury to discuss. And whether there's automobile insurance is not a permissible subject to discuss.
Well, I'm not suggesting the bailiff could accede to the role of the trial court judge, but the bailiff, it seems to me, correctly advised the members of that one member of the jury that had spoken to him something along the lines of, hey, you know, don't worry about that. You'll get everything you need to decide this case and focus on that, or, again, something along those lines. So how can you conclude, I guess, that the jury was concentrating on this insurance item? How is it that, I mean, you have the question, but you also have the response, and then you have it isolated to one person. Of course, none of us know what they said, right? And that's the rub?
Well, other jurisdictions considering this very same question, Justice Salter, have concluded that this failure to give the jury instruction, the pattern jury instruction on insurance, is reversible error because no other instruction covers this subject. The bailiff told him, you'll get your answer in the court's jury instructions, and of course, that never happened.
But most of the other cases deal with juries asking questions. This is one juror asking the bailiff, is there anything in the record that gives us any indication that it went beyond that one bailiff, one juror asking the one question to the bailiff?
Well, that's the problem, is we don't know. And of course, shortly after this question being asked, we come back with a verdict of $18,000, which is an incredibly low verdict when you consider that there's $50-some thousand in medical expenses, and all of the testimony was that the injuries to Dr. Whelan were permanent. So I think it's a fair inference that the jury had this question of who pays for the verdict on its mind, and they never got an instruction on it, which should have happened. I mean, it was requested, and our request was denied. Another issue that came up during this trial was the defense's motion to prohibit us from making a per diem damages request to the jury. Their motion was granted. And because of our audience here today, I'll elaborate a little bit if I may. per diem is a Latin word that means for each day. And as an example, we might ask a jury for damages of $100 per day or per diem. Our jury instructions require the jury to consider a number of categories of non-economic damages. The court's aware: pain and suffering, mental anguish, loss of enjoyment of life, disability. Our pattern jury instructions tell the jury that they're supposed to consider the past, in other words, the time from the crash till the time of trial, and the future, from the time of the trial until the defendant's life expectancy. And there's a jury instruction given on that. And at trial, when we question the witnesses, we ask them, what have you observed about how the injuries affect this person in their daily life? And the evidence here was that it affects Dr. Wieland in any number of ways. It affects him at night when he sleeps. It affects him at work during his work day. It affects him in his leisure activities. And so,
let me, if I could, Mr. Bornes, I'm sorry to interrupt, but thank you for that explanation. I know that's probably really helpful. Is the answer to this issue in your mind the adoption, in this case, of a per se rule that allows or requires, whenever a plaintiff wants to, the ability to give a per diem argument? Or is it more on a case-by-case basis?
Well,
and the reason I ask, if I could, while you're thinking about the answer, the reason I ask is this. It seems like there are a class of cases or classes of cases in which a plaintiff's non-economic damages might be fairly static. In other words, you know, the difficulties they confront one day may look very much like the difficulties that they confront the next day. However, there are other cases, this may be one, where a plaintiff testifies, you know, I have good days and I have bad days. I have ablation, and that helps me for 12 months. So is it possible that there could be a rule that allows the court to exercise discretion based upon the evidence, as it would in many other instances for instructions, as to whether to give that, or as to whether a limitation on the per diem argument is appropriate or not?
To have a bright line rule, I think the easiest bright line rule is, as a general rule, these types of arguments are permissible as long as the plaintiff demonstrates that these injuries are more likely than not or probably going to affect this person going forward. I think that's that's the easier to apply proposition. And, you know, the difficulty, Justice Salter, with that is, and I've had this experience myself, this comes up at trial, and we've got one judge who says, yes, you can do it. And I think we cited to the court to a number of our trial court orders that we've had saying, yes, you can do it. Well, then we've got other trial judges who say, well, you know, I just don't like it. I mean, I've literally had that experience. I just don't like it. Other trial judges have said, well, this is golden rule argument, which, of course, it's not. I mean, I've had that experience as well. And so I would respectfully suggest that this court needs to tell us, is this a permissible legal argument? Is this court going to join the vast majority of jurisdictions that have considered this and held that per diem damages calculations are permissible?
Counsel, even if we were to do that, going back to an earlier question with regard to the standard of review here, so if we're reviewing this circuit judge's decision not to give it, how do we get to an abuse of discretion where we don't have a current general rule with regard to this issue?
So in this case, we weren't allowed to make any kind of damages analysis. We had the prohibition on making a per diem argument. We weren't even allowed to ask for a certain sum of money per year from the jury. All we were able to do was ask for a lump sum of money and provide, and we weren't allowed to provide any analytical framework. So I would respectfully suggest that's an abuse of discretion, and that limited our ability to explain to the jury, here's what the testimony means in light of the law, here's what it means in light of the evidence that you heard, and to provide the jury some context, some meaning for assessing damages that are not easily calculable, these non-economic damages.
Counsel, did you attempt to make an offer of proof setting forth how you wanted to argue this to the jury?
It was handled in a motion in limine, and then and again, I'm not one to purposefully try to circumvent a motion in limine, but I did at trial ask the jury for an award of $75,000 per year, and the objection was made, the objection was sustained at trial. So I believe the issue is preserved.
So, and that was, and actually you broached that in voir dire initially, and you're right, there was an objection. It was sustained on this per diem basis, but that might be a misnomer, right? It's not so much a, it's not as formulated that way, it's not really a per diem argument, it's per annum argument, it's whatever you want to call it, whatever Latin phrase works. And the more central argument it seems like you're making is that there ought to be some way, maybe it's a discretionary call, for a judge to, when the evidence merits it, allow plaintiff's counsel to put some form or structure into their non-economic damages calculation rather than just putting a number out there. That seems to be it.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's kind of what the trial court, the Supreme Courts that have considered this have said. I mean, it provides the jury with an appropriate analytical framework to help put a value on these damages that, frankly, are difficult to calculate.
Do you, can you envision, though, if that rule has merit, can you envision instances where, or as part of the rule, that the trial court exercises discretion to determine whether the evidence in any particular case supports that sort of compartmentalized or incremental argument? Would you agree that that seems appropriate?
It's hard to answer that question in the abstract, Justice Salter. You know, as a general rule, I think if the person is able to demonstrate that it's more likely than not that they're going to have continuing issues in the future, I would respectfully suggest that the bright line rule should be that a per diem damages calculation is allowed. Now, if that is not present, then yes, I would concede that that the trial court should not should not allow a per diem argument if there is no future damages.
Your time
I see
is
that
up,
my time has expired.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Carpenter, you may proceed with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Melanie Carpenter, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Patrick Booman. We're here today to respectfully request this court uphold the jury's verdict. During the four-day trial in this case, the jury heard from two medical doctors, three chiropractic doctors and experts, one accident reconstructionist, one massage therapist, and six lay witnesses. Over 75 exhibits were introduced for their consideration. They carefully considered the evidence and the court's instructions, and they found that Mr. Booman was negligent, and they also found that Dr. Whelan was contributorily negligent due to his excessive speed, although it was slight in comparison. They determined that Dr. Whelan was injured in the accident, and they awarded him damages accordingly. Dr. Whelan received a fair trial here. He simply does not like the result that the jury reached, and he's went to great lengths in presenting eight arguments to seek reversal, many of which are not even properly before this court. And I'd like to start by addressing the contributory negligence argument. There was sufficient evidence and inferences that the jury could have drawn. A reasonable jury could have found that Dr. Whelan was negligent and that his negligence was a legal cause of this accident. Dr. Whelan was negligent. That is undisputed. The EDR, or electric data recorder, from his vehicle recorded that he was going 69 miles per hour prior to the accident. The speed limit there was 65 miles per hour. Speed limits are in place for a reason. The legislator determined that 65 miles per hour is the safe speed that you should be going on that particular roadway. Now, the jury found that, and they also found that his negligence was a legal cause of the accident. The evidence showed that Mr. Booman was making his U-turn. He saw Dr. Wieland. He saw him coming toward him on the roadway. Mr. Booman had extensive driving and training in as a highway patrol officer. He knew how to take evasive maneuvers. And instead of attempting to make the full 180-degree U-turn, he made a 90-degree turn and tried to go south and get his vehicle off the roadway and into the ditch. So the vehicles were perpendicular to one another at that point. He was accelerating into the ditch when he was hit, and he actually made it onto the shoulder of the road, which is where this accident happened. The impact was on the shoulder. At the same time, Dr. Whelan, who had seen Mr. Booman as well, he was braking hard, and he slowed his vehicle from 69 to 44 miles an hour, and he also steered his vehicle to the right and onto the shoulder.
So are you suggesting that the plaintiff was negligent in trying to avoid the accident?
I'm not, Your Honor. I'm just explaining where everything happened and kind of the timeline.
So your theory of negligence is he was going over the speed limit?
Correct. Yes, that's true. The front passenger corner of Mr. Wieland's vehicle sideswiped the rear passenger corner of Mr. Booman's vehicle. And as Dr. Ogden testified, and as the photos showed, only 15 inches of Mr. Wieland's vehicle struck, or Dr. Wieland's vehicle struck Mr. Booman's vehicle. So this isn't a case where the accident happened instantaneously, where neither party saw the other and they didn't have any opportunity to take any meaningful evasive actions. Both parties were working hard to avoid the accident here, and they had that opportunity. Now, all of the members of the jury were experienced drivers here. They understood that had Dr. Wieland been traveling slower, he would have reached that point of impact slower, and he would have had more opportunity to brake longer. And at the same time, Mr. Booman would have been accelerating further and had more opportunity to get off of the road. We're talking about basically a foot. And that 4-mile-an-hour difference, a jury certainly could had enough evidence, and they had enough evidence they could draw reasonable inferences for that speed, that increase in speed, had he not been doing that, that 1 foot could have cleared, and there would be no accident here.
So, counsel, I take it your position is that this is when they had this information that you referred to that was provided to them as a matter of common sense, they could connect the dots rather than needing an expert to specifically get them there? And I'm referring to your opposing counsel's argument, which seems to be to the contrary.
Right. I think that's absolutely right, Your Honor. Again, they're able to bring in their personal experiences and their experiences as drivers and their common sense. And common sense would tell you, we're talking about a foot. It didn't hit, the front of Trooper Booman's vehicle. It didn't hit him right in the dead center of it. It clipped just a foot.
I misread that testimony where he said he drifted to the right?
Mm-hmm.
Did I misread that, or am I right on that?
No, you are correct, yes. So basically the impact was on the shoulder.
It was on the shoulder.
It was, yes. So if Mr. Wieland would have continued going straight, then again, we would have.
Now, I know that wasn't really argued, maybe a lot, but again, the jury hears things. You know, we don't know what they might have used. I have a couple questions about the record, but the first one I have, and I meant to ask Mr. Bornes this, and he can respond when he gets up again, but I didn't see a ruling from the circuit court on the issue specifically of whether there had to be an expert. And I was wondering whether, actually I did see it, but I didn't see the argument that there had to be an expert. And at trial, there was certainly an argument that for judgment as a matter of law by the plaintiffs on the issue of contributory negligence, no question about it. I didn't see any reference to expert testimony. However, when the court ruled on it, the court said, I don't think you have to have an expert. And then we have it in the briefs. So, but I couldn't find it in the pretrial submissions either. So I just wondered if that was, whether it was or it wasn't, it looks like the court ruled on it and put it in the context of an expert opinion context. So maybe it's not a big issue. I just couldn't see where that was ever really argued.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't recall it coming up in the pretrial. I think maybe in the motion for judgment as a matter of law after the trial, it may have been raised at that point.
Yeah, I think the court referenced it. I don't know if anyone else did, but as I say, as long as the court was aware of it and put it in those terms, maybe that's enough to preserve that particular argument.
Right, and basically, this court has held numerous occasions that you don't necessarily need an expert to establish causation. I mean, we didn't. The plaintiff didn't have an expert to establish that Mr. Booman's negligence was a cause of the accident. I mean, juries are allowed to determine whether negligence is a cause of an impact, an accident, all the time, and probably most times without having an expert, because these are things that a jury's familiar with. They drive, they understand speed, they understand that if you're going faster, you're going to get somewhere quicker. They understand when we're dealing with a matter of just a near miss, a sideswiping accident, they're able to make those inferences and draw those conclusions.
But this is a case where really the jury was asked for more precision, weren't they, in the sense that, you know, we're talking about 3 or 4 miles over the speed limit versus if he's going 80, 85, that's pretty easy for the jury to figure out. But here we're talking about a couple, 3-4 miles over the speed limit. Isn't that a different scenario? And isn't that going to raise the specter of every single time a person is going over the speed limit? We have black boxes now, and we know how fast they're going. They're automatically, somebody runs a stop sign, automatically you're contributory negligence, and it goes to the jury without any expert testimony. Because it's the precision in this case that's troubling for me, that the jury had to...
I respectfully disagree with that, Your Honor, because I think what we're dealing with is it's a case-by-case basis. So if someone's going 1 mile an hour over, maybe 1 mile an hour over in a 35 mile an hour, or, you know, if it speed limit's 10, I mean, it's all about degrees here. And 69 versus 65, that's a 10% increase in how fast he should have been going. And he could have been, he certainly could have went slower. There's no prohibition against going under the speed limit. I think there was sufficient evidence. And again, Mr. Barnett didn't like the calculations, but the calculations were there if the jury wanted to make them.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. I saw the reference in the brief to the time over distance calculation, and I saw it was actually even used in the submissions by you in front of the circuit court. I did not see that in the trial court, or excuse me, in the trial transcript. I saw sort of an effort to elicit some of that information from Trooper Booman himself, but I don't know that it actually came together. Is that formula, you cover this much time over this much distance, is that really in the trial record so that the jury would have had it?
The setting it out step by step, no. But again, we can't dig into the minds of what the jury was doing. The question today is, did they have sufficient evidence to draw a reasonable conclusion and to draw the reasonable conclusion that they did? And if Mr. Bornitz wants to apply the summary judgment standard, I mean, it's in a rare, rare situation when issues of negligence and contributory negligence aren't for the jury. And that's for these reasons. They had these facts, they had the photos, they had the testimony of the parties, of Dr. Ogden, they had the EDR information, and they're all drivers. And I would submit to you that if we say in an instance where he's completely speeding, we know that as a fact, he hits by 1 foot, he could have missed it if he had been going slower. I mean, in that instance, if we're going to impose a requirement of an expert testimony to establish contributory negligence, then we're going to need one for almost every auto accident case going forward. We have to give the jury their ability to use their common sense. This is not something that's so outside the realm of their knowledge, which is what the standard is. It's not whether this person needed surgery or, this building was built incorrectly. This is driving. And they all did it. They've all done it for years and years and years, and they understood the situation here. And we would submit, Your Honors, that this issue was properly submitted to the jury.
Can you address?
I would use that as a segue into the insurance part. You just said we can't dig into the mind of the jurors, and I'm going to ask you to dig into the mind of the jurors.
Sure.
Mr. Bornett says he presented evidence that there are X dollars of medical expenses incurred by the doctor, and the jury awards one-third X. And he says we should infer from that they were considering insurance. Tell me what logical argument supports the one-third award of the actual medical costs.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think there was overwhelming facts that supported the jury verdict. The jury heard from Dr. Ogden that this was a minor, low-impact accident. The change in velocity that Dr. Whelan experienced was 7 miles per hour. Mr. Boomans was less than 5 miles per hour. This was a forward impact as opposed to a rear end impact, which they heard there puts less torque on the body in those types of impacts. They also heard that as a result of this impact, Dr. Whelan's neck would not have moved outside the normal range of motion. And Dr. Carlson said that in an instance where you're not exceeding a normal range of motion, there should not be an injury.
Is your argument that some of the medical expenses that he incurred were not necessary?
No, that's not what we're arguing, Your Honor. We're saying they're not related to this accident. So Dr. Carlson came in. He testified that Dr. Whelan suffered a sprain strain to his neck that resolved within 6 to 12 weeks. Dr. Carlson said a reasonable amount of medical treatment for this injury that resolved would be 3 times a week for 6 to 12 weeks, either chiropractic or physical therapy. And the jury heard and had evidence before them from the plaintiff that treatment at the Ortman Clinic would be $56 a time. So 3 times a week for 6 to 12 weeks, $56 a time, that's right in that area of where the jury awarded medical expenses, and I think that's exactly what they found. And the jury had all this information that he did. Dr. Whelan did recover. The accident was November 10th of 2017. November 27th, he hiked 45 minutes. December 5th, he was running on a treadmill. He went on a vacation to Florida in December. The end of December, Dr. Whelan stated he was 75% better. January 10th, he jumped on a trampoline. The 13th, he went down a water slide. The 22nd, he jumped on a trampoline. The 24th, it obviously snowed. He was shoveling and snow blowing. 27th, he's back on a water slide. February 10th, his average neck pain is 1 out of 10 on a pain scale. He went to Dr. McDaniel in February. He had full range of motion with no pain. He had normal orthopedic testing. He had normal neurological evaluation. And this was just, he was getting better, better, better. That supported Dr. Carlson's opinion that this was a temporary exacerbation of his pre-existing degenerative changes to his neck. There's so much evidence that the jury looked at and found to support what they did.
Ms. Carpenter, maybe I want to give you a little bit of time to address your standard of care. Notice of review issue on standard of care, if you're prepared to do that.
Sure. And Your Honor, we don't even think that the court needs to get to that point.
My second question, I'm sorry, on the record, I said I had two. My second question on the record relates to that ruling. I can see where it's referenced in the party's judgment as a matter of law at trial, and I know you did it right before the rebuttal case, and I can see where the court just reaffirmed its ruling. And I must be missing it. I can't find where the court, and I saw your submissions to the court, I can't find where it is. Was it at that November 7th hearing?
Yes, the judge ruled.
That's
yes.
What I thought.
Yes.
And we don't have that transcript.
No, I don't believe that's part of the
okay.
record. Yes. Would you like me to address?
Yeah, of course. No. Go ahead with your argument. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, yes, Your Honors, I don't think we even need to get to the notice of review issues. I think that the jury considered all of the evidence. The circuit court made thoughtful decisions, applying the appropriate standards of care, and applying the summary judgment and judgment as a matter of law standards. And I don't think there is any way that the plaintiff, Dr. Whelan, can establish prejudice here. There's more than sufficient facts to support the outcome that the jury reached. One issue with regard to the insurance instruction, I just want to clarify that the question asked of the bailiff, and again, this was not asked from the, in a formal written submission while they're deliberating. The juror asked, where does the money come from? And then the bailiff appropriately responded, and it wasn't brought up again. If they had further questions, they certainly could have resubmitted a question to the court and requested a formal answer. But notwithstanding that fact, the court certainly did not abuse its discretion in making that determination that instruction was not appropriate. The instructions are considered as a whole, and they were more than sufficient to properly instruct the jury.
What's your reasoning for objecting on behalf of your client to the instruction? I mean, they're pretty routinely given, that instruction is.
Your Honor, I don't think that the issue of insurance needed to be brought up at that point. I don't think it was an issue. It was talked about in voir dire, but that comes up in almost every voir dire case where there's an automobile accident. And in my experience, the limiting or curative instruction on insurance is not typically given. So I don't think it impacted one way or the other. Obviously, what the jury did, I don't think there's any way that prejudice can be shown by that other than just speculating and guessing. There's certainly sufficient facts that we've pointed out that support the jury's verdict.
Can you address the issue of the per diem argument that was precluded?
Yes.
You can go ahead and take the time to
answer
the question.
Sure. Just very briefly, Your Honor, I think that, again, that didn't establish any prejudice in this case, and it was clearly within the ability of the trial court judge to determine that it wasn't appropriate here. Basically, it's counsel trying to usurp the function of the jury. It's their decision what to award for these non-economic, kind of amorphous pain and suffering damages. Their decision, not counsel's decision. It's improper argument or testimony by counsel in trying to make these per diem type arguments. And in fact, Dr. Whelan's counsel did tell the jury that he wanted $75,000.
Is it always improper?
I'm sorry.
Or is it always improper, or is it just improper in this case?
Your Honor, in my opinion, I don't think it's proper. I think that's a function for the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bornetz, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Well, certainly a lot of food for thought in this case. The per diem, failing to give pattern jury instruction on insurance when the jury asks during the trial, who pays? Is the defendant going to have to pay for this? All we ask for, we don't ask for perfection when we try cases. I understand. I've tried a lot of cases, and being a trial judge is not the easiest thing to do. There's a lot of different decisions that have to be made. You consider the evidence, you consider the law, and you're trying to make the right decision. But the trial court's errors in this case, I would respectfully submit, were pervasive. I can't think of a case that I have appealed to this court where there have been so many issues alleged by both parties to have been erroneous. And in the end, what we want is a level playing field. We didn't get a level playing field in this case. Does a per diem argument make a difference? I would respectfully suggest that it does. Should it be allowed in every case as a matter of course? I think that the decisions that we cited to the trial court below and the decisions that we cited to this court almost universally say that this is a permissible argument for trying to help the jury provide an analytical framework for damages that are difficult to assess. Were we prejudiced by the question about insurance? I looked at the verdict form here. There were $1,164 in medical expenses that the jury awarded in this case, and Dr. Wieland had over $56,000 in medical bills. And now, as I hear the defense, they're asking this court to presume that the jury somehow awarded Dr. Wieland damages for treatment at the Ortman Clinic, which we never submitted to the jury. Dr. Carlson, in this case, said that he should have been better after 6 weeks to 12 weeks. He didn't have any treatment by a medical doctor during that time. The jury obviously awarded medical bills from a period of time well after 6 to 12 weeks. They didn't embrace Dr. Carlson's testimony in that regard. I see this as a case where we've got a very nice defendant. Okay, he's out there to serve and protect. I've got friends that are law enforcement officers. I have nothing but the highest degree of respect for them. And I think most people that sit in our courtrooms in this country agree with that. And you got this young guy, a nice guy. I wouldn't ever say anything bad about him. He made a bad decision to pull this U-turn when he couldn't see, and that was negligence.
But, so, Mr. Bornes, let's say you win, and there's a retrial. Is this a situation where you sort of have to be a little bit careful about what you wish for? Because if you have a retrial, then the issue of the standard of care becomes live, and you have to contend with SDCL 31.5, which I think is transposed. And that pretty clearly it talks about reckless disregard. And there are cases and secondary authorities, including the restatement, that seem to distinguish that standard from ordinary negligence. I know you disagree with that, why would, if we reach that issue at all, why would we not apply the text of that statute?
And what we're talking about is the due regard statute, Justice Alter?
Yes.
Okay, so I think we cited this court to something like 24 other jurisdictions that have looked at similar statutes and said that what this statute means is two things. One, that you have to drive with due regard, and then the statute also says nor, right? And nor is a second additional requirement. So you have to drive with due regard, which this court routinely equates to negligence. Or, and the second part is you cannot drive recklessly. So, and that's what Judge Bogue determined when he, and we cited the Blacksmith versus U.S. Case to the trial court. And what Judge Bogue, I think, determined was that the legislature would not mean to intend a harsh result here and let law enforcement officers only be found liable for reckless conduct. I think that's exactly what Judge Bogue was concerned about.
So what if you read this statute to say something different. And instead it said the provisions of this chapter, and by the way, that's 3231.5, they weren't transposed. That's the right site. The provisions of this chapter don't relieve the driver of an emergency vehicle from the duty to drive with due care, due regard for the safety of all persons, nor do they protect the driver from the consequences of his reckless disregard for the safety of others. So it seems to be saying not exactly what you think it says. It seems to be saying that the provisions of the chapter 3132 don't absolve someone driving an emergency vehicle from exercising due regard, and they don't shield from the consequences of reckless disregard. Why would they say reckless disregard if that wasn't the standard?
Well, why would they say due regard if that wasn't the standard?
And why wouldn't they say negligence if that was the standard?
Well, I don't know I think if the South Dakota legislature disagrees with the interpretation we have advocated, which is the same interpretation that courts in at least a couple of dozen jurisdictions agree with when looking at similar language, that the South Dakota legislature can amend the statute to provide immunity for law enforcement officers, sort of like they've done when law enforcement officers are engaged in providing emergency care. I mean, when you look at those statutes, the legislature knows how to insulate law enforcement officers. They've done it in the context of providing emergency care, and they chose not to do that here in the context of driving, which, of course, is a ministerial function.
The legislature also has demonstrated an ability to say things in statutes such as negligence, reasonable care, and other things like that. They didn't use that in the statute. They used different words. Is it possible that the regard that is due is a reckless disregard standard? In other words, the due regard is don't breach the reckless disregard standard, which is different than negligence.
Yeah, I would respectfully suggest, Justice Alter, that that would be an erroneous interpretation of the statute and would render the due regard part, which this court has said is equivalent to negligence, a nullity.
It's a one-sentence statute. It shouldn't be that hard, should it?
Well, I wish it was more clear, but this is the language that the legislature chose to use, and when we look at the language the legislature has used in other contexts, like I referred to, when they're providing emergency care, they've said that there's a higher level of insulation that's provided to law enforcement officers. It's certainly an interesting debate, but I think we're on the right side of this here. Getting back to the issue of whether there has to be expert testimony on the issue of causation, which is, I think, how we started the morning out.
Did you argue that? Did you argue expert testimony? Am I missing it?
Yes. Justice Salter, I was looking back when you asked about that. We cited the trial court to the Johnson versus Armfield case. And in Johnson, the reason we cited it was because this court said, quote, "The causal connection between excessive speed and the collision must be established by the evidence and cannot be left to mere speculation and conjecture." And I believe, Justice Salter, that we also cited the trial court to the Steffen versus Schwann's case, to the Harmon versus Washburn case, to the Clarenbeck versus Campbell case, and to the Mudlin versus Hills materials case. So I think this issue was before the circuit court.
It can't be left to speculation. I think that's an accurate statement of the law. I was just trying to figure out whether you said you have to have an expert on these.
Yeah, it's my recollection, Justice Alter, that we did say that. And it's my recollection is that because we cited to the Johnson versus Armfield case in the circuit court, and obviously we cited to it here, and in the post-trial motions, nobody ever said, hey, this issue wasn't preserved. I mean, that was never an argument. So I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank counsel for your arguments this morning and your briefing. It was very helpful. We'll take the case under advisement, and we'll be in recess for 10 minutes.